Brothers in the Dharma. So we've called this retreat, I'm told it's one of the longest ever titles of a retreat, Entering the Tiger's Cave, Tangling Eyebrows with Zen Masters. And it was my idea to have a retreat on this theme. And I must admit, I think that I must have been out of my mind when I suggested the theme to Padmadaka. What was I thinking? Well, I wasn't thinking particularly. Padmadaka kept asking, well, what's the theme going to be? And in the end, I just said, well, just do it on this or something like that. Not quite sure, not quite clear what that would mean. So what was I thinking when I suggested that we devote ourselves this winter to a search for the tiger's cave, the tiger's lair, the abode of the Zen master? The tiger's cave. Human footprints lead there, but no human footprints are coming out. Men have gone in, but apparently no men have returned. They've disappeared, presumably consumed by the tiger. To liken the Zen master to a tiger is very striking indeed. As you all know, tigers are immensely powerful, dangerous, incredibly dangerous, huge, and also incredibly beautiful, orange and black, those incredible eyes. Huge, prowling with immense dignity, tremendously agile when they move, marvellously tranquil when lying at ease with all that latent power. So it's quite something to liken the Zen master to the tiger in his cave. And this was brought home to me quite strongly a few weeks ago. I was visiting my mum, and there's a lot of TV on, and fortunately there were quite a few sort of natural history programmes, which I find are often the best programmes to watch. And this one was about Bill Oddie, the ex-goody, for those of you who know that, but who's now a, I think, quite well-respected natural history person. And he was, he'd gone to the Jim Corbett National Park in northern India, this incredible, or jungle, really, which has been preserved. And he was going there looking for tigers. But he was incredibly shaky and nervous. And eventually, very, very shaky. He wanted to see a tiger, but he was very, very nervous about it. And eventually he told this story. A story of a friend of his who many years before had been visiting the park with, walking around it with a guide and a party. And as they were going back to the camp, they saw huge paw prints in the mud. And the guide said, it's a tiger. And the tiger's nearby. There's a tiger nearby. So they were going back to the camp, and Bill Oddie's friend said, look, I want to go back and take a photo of a particular bird, quite a common bird. I noticed one. I want to go and photo the bird. So he went back, and suddenly the guide and the party suddenly heard this cry, this shout. They ran back, and they found Bill Oddie's friend dead in a clearing, mauled by a tiger. What was peculiar was when he was taken home and they brought home his effects, they developed his film from the camera. And the last shots in the film are of a tiger coming out of jungle, walking around the clearing. He's taking shot after shot. The last shot is of this huge face, the mouth open, the paws up. That was the last shot. You didn't see the photos. He described it incredibly vividly. But that was the last thing he did. It was extraordinary hearing him relate this tale. And Bill Oddie thought that his friend had actually returned, not to photograph this bird, but to photograph the tiger. He really had courted danger. And he didn't return, but you have this weird photographic record. So Bill Oddie was actually very scared but obviously fascinated too. He obviously wanted to see a tiger, but terrified at the same time. And they're going around on elephants, and they see the remains of carcasses, you know, where tigers have been, you know, deer and so on. And at the end of his stay, at the end of his visit, there's a kind of disturbance, and a tiger's come up to the compound, and then you just see a shot of this tiger in the distance, in the grass, walking away, looking, the way they move, the way they walk, it's just so incredibly beautiful, fascinating and dangerous, and he was really stirred up by this. So this, you know, when you start likening a Zen master to a tiger, and of course the Chinese knew what tigers were, knew what they could do, well, you're making a very, very strong statement indeed. And of course, this sort of fascination and this sense of danger can be like that for us in the spiritual life, in the Buddhist life. Maybe even you feel this way about this retreat. This retreat may have seemed fascinating to you. You know, you're drawn to it, feel that there's something that you need here. Whether or not you noticed it was on Zen masters, you know, you felt, well, there's something, there could be something very good here, something important. But maybe, at the same time, maybe it's a little bit scary too. I know people sometimes feel like that way when they come on retreat, come to Padmaloka. They're kind of attracted, but a bit scared at the same time. There's all those, you know, new people, maybe weird people there. You know, and you're doing all that practice, living in a different way. It's kind of attractive, but at the same time feels a bit dangerous. And I have to admit, I feel a bit that way myself when it comes to retreats, even though I've been doing these things for years and years and years. I feel that way myself. I'm very attracted, very interested to, you know, particularly with, you know, following a theme like this, where I'm a little bit out of my you know, usual areas of thought, let's say. And I'm going to be meeting new people, different people. I don't quite know where we're going. I don't know all of you. I don't quite know where we're going. I've got an intuition of, as it were, where I want to go. And I have a practice. But I don't know what I or what you will be entering. But nonetheless, perhaps for that very reason, I want to go into it. I want to go towards the tiger's cave, go towards the tiger, follow the footprints that don't return. Yes. So for some of you, it might come as something of a surprise to hear that the Zen masters of India, China, Korea, and Japan are likened to tigers, and that their abode, their state, if you like, is the tiger's cave. The enlightened master a tiger? Surely an enlightened man should be likened to something a bit more gentle, like a dove or a lamb or something docile and nice and warm and cuddly, you know, like a good dog, you know, a nice retriever or Labrador, always pleasant. Or something like the perfect, maybe a St. Bernard or something, the perfect father or mother perhaps. Always understanding, always sympathetic, no matter what we do, no matter what we get up to, always there for us to stroke and caress. Certainly, the enlightened man, the awakened man in Buddhist tradition of all schools, is always said to be a man of genuine love and compassion, of genuine empathy, of real love and compassion, the love and compassion that springs from wisdom, that is the same, in fact, as wisdom. But we need to take care when we hear this, that the enlightened man is a man of love and compassion. We need to take care that we don't confuse the loving kindness of an enlightened master with what passes for love and compassion in ordinary life, which is so often more like pity and sentimentality. Something that indulges our every whim and fancy, and that in fact shields us from reality, shields us from ourselves. The teachings of the enlightened ones, the awakened ones, do not shield us or comfort us. In the end, they bring us to the way things are. That is what true love and compassion does. It brings you to what you are and what's actually going on. If you want an illustration of this, there's a very, very good film which we saw the other night in the community called Spring, Summer, Autumn, Winter and Spring, which is a genuinely Buddhist film set in Korea about a Korean kind of Zen master and his young charge. And you really get the impression of what real love and compassion is. So for this reason, because we're not talking about sentiment and pity, the Buddha is frequently likened to powerful beasts. He's likened to a lion, traditionally the king of beasts. And his teaching is said to be the lion's roar. Traditionally, when the lion roars in the jungle, all the other animals are silent. So the Buddha's proclamation of truth silences our opinionatedness, silences our false views, silences our petty-mindedness, opens up, in fact, a vast silence that calls us to walk into it and look at ourselves, look at our life as it is. Sometimes the Buddha is likened to the great bull elephant, or just the great bull. Last summer, I was really delighted. We're walking in one of the fields down the road by the river. There were a load of cows and calves coming towards me, and then I realised behind them there was this huge bull, a great dun-coloured bull, beautiful creature, and he just kind of moved through the crowd of cows and calves, you know, with such dignity and, you know, power, kind of all, you know, all kind of in there, in every sinew. Really impressive beast. And, well, we moved through that field pretty quickly, I can tell you. Harquin, the great Zen master of 18th century Japan, one of his disciples once said, "Our master moved like a bull and glared like a tiger." And Buddhist training is sometimes likened to training the bull. We are the bull, or our mind is the bull, which is the same as saying that we are the bull. And in Zen tradition, you get the famous bull herding or ox herding pictures. And here you have this very lovely set of pictures and verses. And our mind is likened to a wild bull that's gone astray, that's just all over the place. We need to find that bull, tame that bull. We need, in other words, to tame all that energy, power, strength. The mind is regarded as incredibly powerful, incredibly creative. And by mind, we don't just mean up there. We mean us, our whole being. So you need to find the bull and tame it. So it expresses awakening, expresses enlightenment. And there's one picture that does occur to me that's incredibly evocative, where, you know, taming the bull isn't about suppressing this creature, but ox herd, the bull herd, is sitting on the back of the bull, playing a flute, really happily going along, gambling along. The energy isn't repressed, it's tamed, channeled, harnessed into endless creativity.